Good morning. Good morning. Okay, this time I'm still soft, but better. Okay. So last time we went from talking about how changing the order of loops affected cache misses, where we said, oh, you know, if we look at a loop, we can see, are we accessing the same thing? Are we accessing adjacent things? And think about spatial and temporal locality and therefore cache misses. And said, well, you know, sometimes just changing the order of those sorts of loops isn't going to actually solve our problem, usually because we find that we have some sort of conflict where if we make our locality better with one thing, it's going to be worse in another. And we can instead kind of choose a compromise by doing this cache blocking pattern where it turns out we end up working on sort of this group of data, and we organize our computation to try to make it so we work on that group of data as much as possible before moving on. And by working on that group of data as much as possible, we're getting as much locality as we can, hopefully. And of course, if we want that locality to be useful, that we're working on that group of data, in a way where it's going to stay in the cache, it needs to fit in the cache. And that's our primary constraint for this technique, that if we can't put more stuff in the cache than it has room for. And that sort of pattern ends up giving us sort of better cache performance than any sort of way of rearranging the loops without messing with how the loops actually work would do. Then we talked a bit about and orthogonal optimization. So all this cache blocking and loop order stuff, this was about looking at our cache performance and how often we had a miss or a hit, and how long those would take, and so on. And with loop unrolling, we're instead looking at just how long it takes to execute sort of normal computation and comparison and jumping instructions that don't necessarily have anything really to do with the cache. And we learned that with our pipeline processor, it seemed like, oh, these instructions, you know, basically complete one per cycle. There's a few exceptions, but it's pretty close to one per cycle. So the first thing we're going to try to do is try to lower the number of those instructions. And loop unrolling gave us a way to do that, because commonly we have this pattern where we're incrementing a counter by one, checking if we're done, and sometimes that's not a big deal, but sometimes our loop doesn't actually do much other stuff. Like, we're just adding one number in the loop. It turns out adding the loop index, comparing the loop index, and doing a conditional jump, that's probably more work than we were really doing in the loop. That's, you know, what we think of as the loop supposed to do. And we can reduce that work with this pattern of, instead of incrementing our index by one, we increment it by some k. And assuming we don't have to deal much with cases where, we have stuff that's left over after we do groups of k items, then we're going to have a very dramatic improvement in how much bookkeeping code we have, that code to manage the loop indices, to check if we're done with the loop, and so on. And then, I misindented this. Do I not have no, this won't work if it's not plugged in. How about that? I wonder it wasn't showing up. Okay. And we also started talking about something that we saw with loop unrolling, which was that loop unrolling exposed to us that the processors we have on our desktops and our laptops probably don't actually work in that sort of pipeline manner. And one way we could observe this is that we could keep decreasing the number of instructions we were running, but the actual performance didn't change very much. And that isn't something which made sense with our pipeline design, where, you know, if you're running essentially the same instructions but had fewer of them, we should spend less cycles in the pipeline design. So we're going to talk about sort of what's really going on and therefore what we can do to make things faster on our real processors that don't work quite like our pipelines. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so I have some slides in the quiz. I'm going to go over, I guess I should go over 3, 4, and 5 probably. So in 3, 4, we were looking at this loop and asking about how many misses do we expect in E and B. So we start with E here. And the pattern is we're doing in the first for J equals 1, or 2 rather, J equals 2, we're doing E of 1. Is that actually? Oh, yes, J equals, for J equals 1, yes, we're doing E of 1. For J equals 2, we're doing E of 2 and E of n plus 2, and so on. And one mistake I've seen people make in these kinds of problems is you look at the beginning of this pattern and you say, oh, so we're typically, we have all this locality here, 1, 2, 3, 4, so that's going to work out great. And, well, it works out great at the beginning of this, but very quickly, we're going to get to a point where these are spaced further and further apart. So notice that the pattern we have is that we have one thing in between these, then two things, then it's going to be three, and so on. So, yes, this locality here is going to help us at the beginning for the small j's, but given that n is really big, we're going to quickly get to a place where they aren't very close together at all. So we don't get to really take advantage of that locality in a way that's going to be significant for our overall estimate, even though, yes, it's going to matter at the beginning of this, but since n is really big, most of the time, this gap, that keeps growing and growing is going to be really big, because even if it's like n over 8, we assume that's still really big, and that's 7/8 of the iterations. And so what we end up saying, therefore, is that we estimate that we basically have no real locality. We're skipping by n, and once we get to having a large enough number of iterations, it's going to be too long before we get back to the same value or something near the same value. Because like once we get to, say, j equals n over 8, we assume that's a big number, and that's the, and then we're going to have n over 8 times before we get back to something close by, even though, yes, in the sort of beginning, it looks like we have spatial locality, but that's going to quickly kind of disappear. And in the other case, we had this case where the pattern was we would do basically plus 1 each iteration. Oh, I forgot a b of 1. And we just keep doing this pattern. So basically, most of the time, especially as n got bigger, we'd be doing plus 1. And that meant we would have a hit if it was in the same block as the previous thing, and that happens 1/4 of the time when 4 things fit in our blocks. Because if we think of what happened when we had blocks that fit 4 things, we would load the first thing in the block, that would be a miss. Then if we accessed the other 3 things in the block, those would be 3 hits. Then we'd be out of the block if we kept advancing. We'd load the first thing in the next block, that would be a miss. Then we'd have 3 hits when we access the next things. So we'd expect about 1/4 misses, given that the problem said 4 things fit in a cache block. So questions about question 3 or 4? Okay. So then question 5. We showed you a bunch of loops and asked which of them had the best cache performance. So we were asking about cache performance specifically, not about which is faster, because those are different things. And this was the only option where we had some spatial locality in both B and C. The other options were all ways where we did something weird about how we did the loop indexing, but if we looked at the axis pattern, we were basically accessing I doing stuff for I plus one, I plus two, or j plus one, j plus two, but this kind of combines them because it's doing basically blocking with 2x2 blocks. And so we have spatial locality in B and C, which none of the other options did. Some questions? Yes?
Can we go over question one?
We go over question one. So in question one, we can look at the access pattern here. And initially, I and j are 0, so we're accessing index 0. Then j is 1, and I is 0, so we're accessing index 3, then 9, and so on. And you might say, wait a moment, are we accessing 0 and 0? Yes, sometimes we are doing that, but that's not going to change the number of misses because, you know, if we've just accessed this for the comparison, then this better be a hit, given that there's no accesses in between. And in the problem, we have the work worked out, and if we think of how this array should work, assuming the beginning of the array maps to set 0, we have indexes 0 and 1 would map to set 0, indexes 2 and 3 would map to set 1. Indexes 4 and 5 would map to set 0. 6 and 7 to set 1. 8 and 9 to set 0. And 10 and 11 to set 1. So you can say that we can just track what happens in each set individually, and we don't have a regular pattern like we did in some of the things in the lecture. So we had this in pattern, and I think everything goes here. Probably this should not have been, update LSU should not be in there because, oh, right, you had two things that fit in a set because it was a two-way cache, so you need to also track which was least recently used. Because in the case, where's our example here? So when we have this miss here, for example, 4 should go to set 0. And we don't want to replace 8 and 9 because that is what we want to replace 8 and 9 because we most recently accessed 1. Right, so 1 is the most recent thing, so we just need to pay attention to that. It's part of simulating this. Does that answer your question? Other quiz questions? Okay, so let's talk about, go back to what happens on real CPUs. So we're going to talk about how make real processors work, and there's two things that they're going to do. We're going to do something we'll call multiple issue, that we're going to start multiple instructions every cycle, that it's not going to be good enough to run one instruction per cycle because, you know, we're kind of at the limit as like to how short our pipeline stages can be. So we're going to have to start multiple every cycle, and this means that we're going to have to do a bunch of work to forward values. We're going to want to run instructions out of order, that at when we have a cache miss like here, you know, it was in our pipeline processor, we have to stall this subtract instruction, and that means all the instructions after it can't go. But, you know, if we look at those instructions, in this case, we can do better. Those instructions don't really care about the value of the memory access, so we could just do them early. And this is something we're going to want to do. But the issue with this is that it's going to make hazards a lot harder to handle. So in our single-stage pipeline, we were mentioning that we had this idea of, you know, that we usually forward from the most recent stage, and this doesn't work if we're executing instructions out of order. We're executing instructions out of order. Sometimes it will end up that the instruction in the most recent stage is not the most recent version of the value, and sort of. And also, it can sometimes end up that we actually need to keep around versions of the value that are older than the most recent one in order for other pending instructions to run. So our solution to this is that we're going to think about tracking versions of values. That rather than saying that this add instruction here writes to R8, I'm going to say it writes to R8 version 2. And rather than saying the second add instruction writes to R8, I'm going to say it writes to R8 version 3. And by doing this, we're going to be able to resolve our which version value do we forward, because when I check where do I get R8 for the second add, I'm going to say I get it from R8 version 2. So it has to match version 2. If it doesn't match version 2, I'm not going to forward it. It's the wrong one. So we're going to want, and we're also going to want to track these versions, because if we're writing instructions out of order, the last instruction that runs might be not the one we want to have the final value of R8. These version numbers are going to let us solve that problem too, because we'll know, if I have these two instructions, which one do I want to be the current value of R8? The one with the highest version number. So to implement this idea, we're going to have lots of extra registers, and we're going to assign each version a new real register. So we're going to have separate what we'll call architectural registers. I'm using the term architectural because of instruction set architecture. So these are the ones that you know about in assembly, from physical registers, the ones the processor actually uses it to implement. And we're going to keep track of this mapping from architectural to physical registers, and we're going to have a stage in our pipeline that's going to take instructions in, and before we run them, we're going to change the registers to use these physical registers instead of the architectural ones that we see in assembly. And we're also going to take advantage of this to handle running the instructions at the right time. So one thing we saw is that these out-of-order execution is supposed to run instructions when their operands are ready. How do we track that? Well, if each register represents only one version of a value, now we have a convenient way of having tracking whether that version is ready. We just have to mark that register is ready, and that's the same thing as saying the right version of the value is ready. So I'm going to go through here. Here's the kind of design modern processor would have that implements this out-of-order idea. So we're going to have a whole bunch of extra pipeline stages here. The actual details of an implementation will vary substantially. And there's probably some things I'm doing here which are a little simpler than a real implementation. For example, my fetch takes one cycle, which is probably not common. But one thing you might notice here is we have our fetch. It goes into this decode, which is probably actually decode, not register read, like actually parsing the machine code. And we also have a whole bunch of branch prediction here. So one thing which comes up in these out-of-order processors is that because we can go run so many instructions per cycle, it becomes a lot more important to predict branches, because we don't want to wait until those instructions run. And if we wait 3 cycles on this processor, that's 6. That can be like 6 or 8 instructions. So we want to predict things further ahead and more often correctly, so we don't have to undo 6 or 8 instructions, which is a much bigger penalty than our pipeline processor. We only had 2. Here on these out-of-order processors, often a branch misprediction, you might have 20 instructions you started it you're going to get rid of and try again. So we're going to have a lot of complicated branch prediction. And also, note that this branch prediction needs to also, to make this processor efficient, predict not only if the branch is taken or not, but also where it goes before we have full information about it. As typically, these processors, both for predicting whether a jump is taken or not and where jumps go, will have some tables that are sort of organized like caches, so they can usually get that information even if they can't parse the instructions fast enough. They can just remember, last time this function call went here, so even though I have to look up what class it is to go make the function call, I'm going to predict where it goes and try to run that faster. Yes?
So would it be like a map where you have something that leads to something else, and you kind of map out what's going on?
Question, will it be like a map?
So the question will
if one prediction is wrong, will it have the other options or so on? So usually not. So usually the sort of structure might be, so it's going to look like a cache. It will look like a cache in the sense that it will have like an index and a tag, but we'll look it up with, say, our jump instruction. And this cache, rather than having like the value of memory there, will have information about, oh, last time I saw this, this was a jump that went here. A conditional jump that went here, and it will use that information to do the prediction. Does that answer your question? Okay, so, and in the case where we get the first prediction wrong and we have others afterwards, that's mostly going to be we have a lot more instructions to undo, too bad. But it is actually going to be very common. We'll make a prediction, make another prediction, make another prediction, make another prediction, find out like the first prediction is wrong and have to forget all of those instructions we started and try again. Okay, so then we have this step here where we do the renaming and also what I call dispatch. So we're going to rename the instructions and dispatch them to this queue here. So unlike our pipeline processor, we're not going to do one instruction. You're not going to sort of do the instructions in order. So we're going to have this part of the pipeline here, which does the instructions as they are ready. So this part of the pipeline here, I would call is the out of order part. So everything before that, the instruction queue here is, this is going to try to run the instructions in order. By in order, I mean in the order you'd expect them to run if you were doing one instruction per cycle. And this last part is also going to do things in order. It's going to do some work to finish up instructions, and we're going to do that in order. But the middle of this pipeline is going to be the out of order part. We're going to run things as their values are ready, even if that's not the order they're quote unquote supposed to execute if we're thinking of a simpler processor design. So we have this instruction queue. So this holds our renamed instructions that are ready, potentially ready to be run. And we're going to have some information about what registers are actually ready. And using that, we're going to issue, that is, start executing instructions. And when we issue instructions, we're going to, handle reading their values, and we're also going to handle forwarding here. And typically, in these processors, because we want to run a whole bunch of instructions at a time, and because we still want it to be the case that if I do an add, and then another add to the same value, that happens in consecutive cycles, we're also going to do forwarding. So we're going to have pretty complicated forwarding logic and a complicated register file. Why a complicated register file? Because if we want to start, say, three instructions per cycle, we need to read six registers per cycle. We want to finish three instructions per cycle, we need to write three registers per cycle. So we're going to have a register file with lots of ports and also forwarding logic, to hopefully get kind of maximum efficiency for things like if I'm adding to the same thing over and over, we want that to still happen one cycle after another, like our pipeline processor. So then when we issue instructions, they're going to go to one or more what we'll call execution units. So these are the things that actually do the work of the instructions. And in this design, we have execution units for doing math. I have a whole bunch of ALUs. And I also have my sort of data cache listed as an execution unit. I have labeled load store here. So we're going to kind of just say that these are different ways to execute instructions. And usually, we're going to kind of specialize these execution units. And so one way of thinking about this is that for most programs we run, like, I don't need to do three divides at a time. It's OK to have only one thing that can do a divide at a time. So maybe we'll have one ALU here that does more complicated operations, but we won't have multiple copies of that because, you know, usually you don't have to do that many of them at a time to run programs efficiently. But we probably would want a lot of ALUs that can say do adds and subtracts. So we'll have extra two of those, two simpler ALUs. So often we'll specialize these execution units, you know, based on sort of what mix of instructions we expect programs to want to run. Yes? So the question is, could I do simple instructions on the complicated ALU? It depends on the design. I think usually they design it so that does work because there are enough programs which are basically only simple instructions that they want to do that. But a processor designer would basically look at, here are the programs I'm running. Would adding this capability actually help those programs versus, you know, and making this a little slower and bigger and all that? Yeah.
What's the difference between off order and in order?
Can I explain again what's the difference between out of order and in order? So this in order part is going to run sort of in the order that we would expect if we were doing a single cycle processor. And that, even though it's pipeline, yes, but we're going to fetch the first instruction, then the second instruction, then the third instruction, then the fourth instruction. This out of order part, we're going to run the instructions as their values are ready. So if we're ready, because of, like, say, a cache miss, to run the fourth instruction before the second one, that's what this out-of-order part's going to do. And I have maybe something which is more illustrative here. So, like, if we think of what the pipeline diagram looks like, our in-order part, when things are working, is going to do some number of instructions, just sort of, but in lockstep. And our other in-order part, also the same way. But our out-of-order part, you notice, like, kind of skips around based on what values are available. Does that answer your question? Okay, so here. So we have our execution units. We have a write-back stage, typically, that's also going to handle some forwarding. And we have this last stage labeled commit, sometimes it's also called retire, and this finalizes the instruction. So this is going to be done in order. So this does some, the most notable thing that it does that we'll see right now is that if I'm giving a new register for each version of a value, I'm going to run out of registers because I'm just, we have 50 versions of R8, that's 50 registers. So if I keep making more versions of R8, we run out, so we need to reclaim them somehow. This stage is going to handle that by knowing what instructions are fully complete. And this is going to run in order because we don't want to, like, forget about a value until, you know, we know all the instructions before don't need it anymore. And we'll learn later about something called exceptions, which this is also going to help with. And we're not going to talk about it, but I mentioned we have branch miss predictions. We'll need to undo a lot of instructions. This is going to help handle undoing instructions in some cases. And it's useful to have the instructions in the order they're intended to be to do that. Yeah?
Because we're running instructions out of order, would the speed of an out-of-order processor generally scale with the number of stages in the out-of-order phase?
So the question is, because we're running instructions out of order, would the speed generally scale with the number of stuff in the out-of-order phase? So generally, these processors are designed to kind of balance all of these. And a way of thinking about this is, let's say I had a huge out-of-order part, but I could fetch one instruction per cycle. The maximum we're going to achieve over a long period of time is one instruction per cycle. And that's too low. And the same thing is true for this commit stage. If I only can commit one instruction per cycle or two instructions per cycle, that's going to kind of limit my long-term performance, no matter how fancy my out-of-order stuff. So if you look at modern processors, typically they're kind of designed to have roughly the same kind of speed from all the parts, kind of maximum speed, and they want to kind of balance it because if you make the out-of-order part, like, be able to do 8 instructions per cycle, that's probably not going to help you if you can only fetch 4 of them. Even though, yes, sometimes you'll have these kind of bursts, but sort of in the long term, you'll, you know, the best you can average is around 4. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, and so we got, as I mentioned, this sort of pipeline diagram where we have these in-order parts, and then the instruction goes in the instruction queue and it gets fetched as the values are available. So you have this in-order parts, and typically, you know, here I'm showing 2 instructions fetch a cycle. A more typical number on a modern desktop or laptop processor might be 4 or 5. And we'll issue the instructions when their operands are ready, so this will not necessarily be in order. And we will have this final sort of commit stage that completes the instructions that will happen in order. And this is where we'll free up resources that those instructions were using. And also, this is where we'll, you know, have done the bookkeeping so we can handle like a branch misprediction. So let's, yes. Question, the issue state decides which of the ALUs that instruction is going to be done in. This is also where we decide where we re-registers for the instruction in the diagram I showed. So I should mention, I'm showing a possible and relatively realistic pipeline diagram for an out-of-order processor, but all these details vary. But I figure having a concrete example is a good idea. So let's look at this renaming stage. So we're going to do this renaming. How might this work? So let's think about, here's our original program, and I'm going to convert it to renamed versions of the instructions. And to do this, I'm going to have to track what's the current mapping from the instructions in assembly to instructions in the hardware. And I'm going to represent this sort of physical registers, rather. So from registers in assembly to registers in the hardware. And I'm going to represent the registers in the hardware using kind of X and a number, just so we have a clear difference between those and the ones that are kind of real registers in assembly, the fake registers in assembly. And we're also going to have a list of registers that no one's using right now, of these real registers. We're going to use this for renaming. And our renaming process is going to be that we're going to go through each of these instructions, and I'm going to look up each of their operands. So R10, okay, that's X19. So I'm going to use X19 instead of R10. And R8, that's X13. So I'm going to read from X13. But remember, we make a new version for every, a new register for every version. And this instruction produces a new version of R8. So I'm going to cross off the first thing on my free list and make that be R8. And I'm going to rewrite the instruction in this form where I'm tracking 2 sources and a destination. And they're going to have to be different because I want to have a different register for each version of a value. And we read from a different version of R8 than we write to. Yes? Question, do I have to read through the entire code to know? So the question is, like, how did I cross off X13 here? So note that it's X13. So this is, these X numbers are not the numbers that appear in not the registers that appear in assembly at all. And I knew that previously X13 was where I stored the current version of R8. So like R8 version 1 was X13. So X18 is our R8 version 2. So later on, we're going to have something which figures out no one's using X13 anymore, and that's going to be in the commit stage. But that's much later. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Sorry, do you mind repeating why you crossed out the X13?
Question is, why did I cross out the X13? Because after I run this instruction, because I'm storing my result in X18, the current version of R8 is in X18, which means that the next instruction, I want it to read from X18, not X13. And we're going to see that right away. So in the next instruction, I'm using R11, that's X07, and R8, which is now X18. So I'm going to read from those two registers, and I'm going to have to write to yet another new version of R8. I'm going to assign a different register for R8. It's going to be X20. And that's sort of the renamed version of the instruction I'm going to get. So questions so far? Question, why is there more than one renaming? Why, do you mean why is there more than one name for R8?
Yeah.
So if we go back to our example with version numbers, right, we said what we're going to do is we're going to have different mark the versions of R8. So this is what we're doing, but we're doing it by giving a different name for each version of R8. So basically, X13 is R8V1. X18 is R8V2, and X20 is R8V3.
And so the names are based on like the branch predictions, like if it's if you took a correct branch,
so the question, the names are based on the predictions, so this is kind of orthogonal to the prediction. So the names are just based on, we're going through the instructions in order, and each time we write the value, we want a new name. Notice that here there's no jumps or anything like that. We're just saying each time you write a value, you want a new name, because we want to make sure that we, when we're doing things like forwarding or figuring out whether values are ready, that we don't look for R8, we look for a particular version of R8. And these are our particular versions of R8. Okay, other questions? Yeah?
How does this interact with regular forwarding? Because you would think that with the three ad commands, you could probably just forward it normally, that would work. So, I guess, do you still need to forward when you're doing all the new versions?
Question, do we still need to forward when we're doing the new versions? We would still want to forward. And the reason why, if we look at this pipeline diagram, we want it to be the case that we have kind of a forwarding path that handles this, and probably actually even we want to have this forwarding path. So we need to make that work. But as for what the register numbers do, is now that we have a unique register number for each version, we don't have to do the thing you did in the pipeline processor where we have like this mux with if it's in execute, if it's in memory, and so on. We just say if we see a match, we have the right value. We don't have to do, the logic is simpler in that sense because we've paid this cost up front of doing this renaming step. Does that answer your question? Yeah. The question is, the reason why we have the different versions because the pipeline is out of order? Yes, and we'll see how we're going to apply this when we get to the instruction dispatch step. It's going to be useful that we have these different versions. Okay, so then we rename our last instruction. So I look up R12, I find out it's X05, I look up R8, which was X20, and I need a new version of R8, so I get X21 for my list of free registers. Questions on how I did this renaming? Yeah? Do we have to do something similar with memory? Yes. And we're going to mostly gloss over that. But this is, in fact, something processors do. So let's look at kind of a more example. So here, I'm going to rename the first instruction the way we saw before. So I look up R10, it's X19. I look up R8 was X13. I'm going to need a new name for it. I'm going to give it X18. Then I have an instruction that moves to memory. So this has two operands, R8 and RAX. So I look up R8, it's X18. I look up REX, it's X04. And this destination is memory. So we're going to have to talk about how we deal with that. And in particular, something that comes up with memory and running instructions out of order is that these two instructions, they could be accessing the same memory location or overlapping memory locations. And this is something out of order processors need to deal with. And there's kind of two strategies that you could use. The simplest strategy is that you just run these loads and stores in order. That even though you're doing all the arithmetic out of order, you do the loads and stores in this right order. That's the simplest strategy. Turns out that's slow. So processors don't do that. So the alternative strategy is that you have machinery to compare the load and store addresses to detect if there's a problem and adjust the order that way. And usually you like guess that they're not going to overlap and then do something like branch prediction corrections, like undoing instructions if you guess wrong. This is very complicated, and this is the level of detail I'm going to get into and about how it works. But it is, in fact, something processors do, is that they will try to reorder these loads and stores. But it's complicated because you have to worry about what if RAX and 8 plus R11 are the same value or like one apart. What happens? Other questions about this? Okay, so then we have our subtract. We read from R8, which is currently X18. And R11, which is currently X07, and we make a new version of R11, which is going to be from our list of free registers, X20. Then I have an MR move Q, where I'm going to read from R11, which is now X20, and I'll mark the dependency as memory, presumably because something that is going to have to deal with the fact that that uses memory and handling conflicts. And that writes to a new version of R11, which I'm going to get from our list of free registers, is X21. Then I have IR move Q. So IR move Q makes a new version of R8. Doesn't read from R8, so we shouldn't write that down. We shouldn't have a false dependency. So I'm just going to say it goes to my new version of R8, which I'm going to assign to X23. I'm not going to mark it as reading from R8 because we don't need to read R8 to run this instruction. And then I have my add from R11, which is now X21, and R8, which is now X23, and it's going to go into a new version of R8, which I'm going to assign to X24, just getting from my free list. So questions? How I did this process? Okay, so let's look at, do a little exercise. Who would like some more time? Question? Why do we rename REX? So, because given that's the return register, so this renaming process is agnostic to what we use the registers for, right? And on these processors, we're going to predict things like return instructions even. So we're going to like potentially be having in our instruction queue instructions from like a function and the thing that called it at the same time. Okay, so I'll start at the beginning. So at the beginning, I looked up R8, it was X13, R9 was X17, and we're writing to R9, so I'm going to need a new name for the version we're writing. So I'm going to choose X18 by taking the first one of these three registers. Then I move 100 into R10. This move instruction doesn't need to read from R10, so we're going to move 100 into a new version of R10. We can't use the existing one, so there's nothing obviously wrong here. The problem is there might be an instruction up above here that's like add R10 something, right? And we want to make sure we don't just write bad instructions R10. So we need a new version of R10. And I'm going to assign that to my next free register, X20. Then the subtract reads from X20 and the current version of R8, which is X13, into a new version of R8, which is going to be X21. Then this XOR reads from the now current version of R8, which should be X21 because of what we just did, which is going to be X21. The current version of R9, which is going to be X18, and it's going to make a new version of R9, which is going to be X23. And then our add queue, we're going to read from RAX, which is X04 is the physical register you've assigned to that, and from R9, which is now X23. And we're going to write to a new version of R9, which we're going to make a new register for, which is going to be X24. So questions on how I did this process? Yeah.
So basically, it's not when you, so it's when you like use register, you rename it, not just when you write to a register.
The question, when I use a register, I rename it, not just when I write to it. So I always rename the registers because the part of the processor after this rename step only understands physical register names, which are in this example, we're working with X. In the hardware, they're going to be a number. But so we always, yes, do this translation, but we make choose a new register name every time. You know, we update our map to have a new register name every time we do a write. You have a question?
Yeah, I saw that R7.
R11 and R8. Did I?
Like down the map, like in the architecture register.
Oh, this is an error in this diagram. X21 register. Yes.
So. Would this need to change how the instructions work? Because if you're like doing add queue X13, X17, but you want to keep X17, 17 the same and still get a result as 18, then the way it works would be different.
So the question is, to do this, did we need to change the instructions to like take an extra register operand internally? Yes. So in this processor design, generally we're doing this translation where we're taking instructions that had two operands and making them have three, because otherwise it's going to be hard to do our forwarding and hazard detection stuff. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just looking down like when I was fixing the phone that I wrote. Well, what did you write like in the middle of the XRQ like rename portion?
What did I write for the XRQ? So XR21, which is the same register we got from the subqueue, and 18, and I assigned a new register, it ended up being 23 for its result.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions? So one thing we saw changing the instructions in this renaming step, besides using different register names, was changing the three operands. Often processors will also deliberately do other changes. So for example, if we have a push instruction, that needs to read from the stack pointer. So one part of the step will be making the stack pointer an explicit operand. Or if we have compare and conditional jump instructions, we need to deal with the condition codes. So another thing we might do to handle that and allow us to run those out of order is we might make the condition codes be an explicit operand rather than this implicit one. And also, this gives us the opportunity to, say, convert a complicated instruction like pop into simpler instructions. And many modern processors will do that, have that sort of way of processing instructions like pop, that they'll actually convert them to other instructions. And it's not that big of a deal because they have to do this renaming step anyway, so it's not that hard to add this extra logic to split it up into two instructions in that case. Questions? Okay. Oh, I have bad register numbers. And that's still wrong. But okay. So let's talk about how this instruction queue part works, which is probably interesting. So we're going to get a bunch of renamed instructions. Is there a question? Sorry.
Sorry, I had a question on the previous slide. I was just wondering how, so like, the condition codes will now not be like an implicit register, they'll be stored in like a physical register, and then the compare and jump instructions will like use a physical register to assign.
So question, in this design, the condition codes would be in a physical register, and the compare and jump instructions would use a physical register to store the information? Yes, so this is one possible way of handling condition codes in this design. There's some other ways, so it's not the only option. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at how this dispatching instruction works. So here, I have two instructions I can dispatch to, and I'm going to look at my instructions. I'm going to say, okay, I have my first instruction. I'm going to have this list of, for each register, is it ready? And basically what I'm going to do every time is I'm going to look at the instruction, say, are its operands ready? And if so, I'm going to put it on one of my ALUs. And here I find out, okay, 0 and 5, they're ready, so I can run that. Look at the next instruction, 2 and 6, not ready. 3 and 7, not ready. 4 and 8, not ready. So it turns out, even though I have this long list of instructions, only one of them can run. Even though I have two ALUs, I can only use one of them. And this is actually a pretty common thing that happens in these out-of-order processors, that they'll have a lot of ALUs ready, but because of dependencies between instructions, we can only run one at a time. So then we're going to run that instruction, and we're going to look at the next instruction. We can't run it, but after the first cycle, now we're going to have the value of X06 ready. It's going to be ready to be forwarded. And then we're going to do this analysis again and find out, oh, I can now dispatch the second instruction. So now its operands are ready. It finishes. It's going to mark 7 as ready. And then I'm going to look at the next instruction and say, now I can run that. And so on. And then that's going to mark 8 as ready. And then when that happens, we're finally going to get to a point where we can
run. This should probably be, why is that extra? And then we're gonna finally get to a point where I think this should be 8 here, but where we can look at instructions and say, now we have two things ready. So here, I'm gonna look at 4 and 8, and I'm gonna say, okay, the first one, we need to have 4 and 8 ready. The second one, we need to have 1 and 8 ready. So finally, I can run two instructions. I can run the comparison and this add. And notice I skipped over the jump not equal because it needs the comparison to run first. Can't do that. Can't check the condition codes yet. So I run those, and then I keep doing this process here. And I mark those as ready. Then I find out I can run 5 and 7 because now 9 is ready and 10 and 2 are ready. And I schedule those and I just keep trying. So every step I'm going, I'm saying, let's see what operands are ready and run as many instructions as I can fit in my ALUs or other execution units as I can using things that are ready. And we mark things as finished based on when we know they're going to go through all these execution units. So questions? And so this is where all that work doing registry naming has kind of made it so we have a practical way of actually running instructions, that we can look at what registers are ready, run those instructions, and run them as their operands become ready. And we can also have this happen, skip over this example for time, but sort of the basic, I'll go through the first few. So here, we're looking at this example. Hey, here I have two different types of execution units. I have an ALU and data cache. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to say, can I run this instruction? Is 4 ready? Yes, so I can. So I'm going to run instruction 1 on the data cache. Then I'm going to look at the second one. Can I run this instruction? No, because the data cache is full. Can't put it there. Yes, its operands are ready, but I can't fit it on the ALU. It needs the data cache. Then I look at this instruction. Can I run it? Needs 1 and 2. Those are ready. So I'm going to run instruction 3 on the ALU. So that's what I do in the first cycle. And then what's going to happen as a result is then I'm going to have 6 is going to become ready, and 8's going to become ready, and I'm going to have instruction 1 done and instruction 3 done. I'm going to repeat this process. So I'm going to look at first, can I run instruction 2? Is 5 ready? Yes, it is. So I'm going to put instruction 2 on the data cache in cycle 2. And then I'm going to say, can I run instruction 4? Is 1 ready? Yes. Is 6 ready? Yes. So I'm going to put instruction 4 on the ALU. I just repeat this process every cycle, trying to fit as many instructions as I can based on, are there things ready, and do I have a place to put them? Yes?
Just to make sure I'm understanding about the data cache you're using, are we using that whenever we have like a memory store or load operation, and we have to preserve that value in the data cache until that instruction is done?
So the question is, am I using the data cache whenever I load and store? Yes. It's our execution unit that handles loads and stores. And as for preserving that value, I'm not going over how we deal with what if we have a misprediction or run things out of order. So ignoring that, we just need to load the value from the data cache to execute this MR move queue. Does that answer your question? So the question is, why in the first cycle we couldn't use the instruction? Well, my assumption here is my data cache handles one load per cycle. That I don't have a data cache. My data cache can only do one thing at a time. So if I had a data cache that could do 2 at a time, then yeah, I could do both. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So what kind of instructions
Question, what kind of instruction does the data cache handle? What kind of instruction does the ALU handle? So the data cache, it's our way of accessing memory. So the instructions that access memory, the data cache will handle those. The data cache can't do arithmetic. You need an ALU for that. Okay, so let's talk briefly about the execution units we dispatched to. So some of the execution units are going to be pipelined, so often we'll have like an ALU that takes multiple stages. So let's say we have this ALU, which has three stages. How long should it take to compute A times B times C times D? Like so. Anyone? So if we think of what the timeline for this is going to look like, we're going to first put in C times D here. And then that's going to take three cycles. And after that, we're finally going to be able to put in B times the result of that. We can't do it earlier because, well, we don't know what to put in yet. And that's going to take another three cycles. And then we're going to be able to put in the result of that. And it's going to take nine cycles. Now, this is pipeline. You might say, wait, no, it shouldn't be faster. Well, it is faster, but not for doing things with dependencies. So for example, we could, you know, if we had to multiply some E times F, we could do that sort of kind of overlapping with this calculation. But we can't do this. This calculation has too many dependencies for us to actually like take advantage of it being pipelined, really. Questions? Yeah.
Where it says one operation per cycle or three cycle latency, does that mean like, I guess I'm confused why we don't call it like one operation per three cycles kind of?
Question, why do I say one operation per cycle? I'm measuring the throughput. Because if we think of running lots of multiply instructions, well, I can start one every cycle and finish one every cycle.
But not
when they're dependent. Yeah?
In this case, we have like three ALUs, so does it mean like we're splitting the execution state into three cycles?
Question, in this case, I have three ALUs. I have one ALU that's split into three pieces. So in this case, it's yes, the execution stage in this has three cycles. Okay, other questions? Sometimes we'll have ALUs that work in a different way. So let's talk about what goes on with these processors. So I have this more complicated example here. We'll skip over that for time reasons. And we'll talk about what's a consequence of this design we saw. And a big consequence is something we've seen in our examples, and that comes up in sort of real examples, especially when we have longer. We have ALUs that take multiple cycles, so we don't have the results available in one cycle and so on, is often, even though we have all this machinery to have this big list of waiting instructions and keep track of what values are ready, often we still can't find work to do. That will look through every single instruction in our instruction queue, and we'll find out that, well, not ready, not ready, not ready, not ready, not ready, because of dependencies. And this is something that we as programmers can do something about. So let's talk about how to reason about what these processors do to help us think about that. And here I have a diagram kind of showing the dependencies between instructions. And those are what's going to matter because we learned that when do we run an instruction out of the instruction queue? When its dependencies are ready. So we can think of this as representing each of these circles and ovals is representing an instruction, and the arrows representing how values flow from one instruction to another. So this is often called a data flow graph. And if we think of what our processor is going to do, it's going to run this add instruction I have represented here when after that one and the load run. So we can use this to reason about what things can run at the same time, what things need to run one after another. And one thing we can see here is that in this sort of representation of this sort of unrolled sum loop, that it looks like we basically need to run three things, that we can run three things per cycle. We have these three independent things, right? These are things which we could dispatch at the same time, because there's no dependencies between them, so that all their operands could be ready at the same time. But if we look at these adds, we need to do these one at a time. We can't dispatch the first add until we do the second add until we do the first add. We can't dispatch the third add until we do the second add, and so on. So these are going to have to happen one at a time in our out-of-order processor. Even though that processor can do lots of adds at a time, potentially, not going to matter. We have to do the first add, then the second add, then the third add, because only one's going to be ready at a time. And the book calls this borrowing from sort of our processor hardware circuits the critical path for this code. That this is going to limit our performance. And in particular, if our adds take, for example, one cycle, this is going to take, you know, four cycles. And no matter how many ALUs we have, no matter how fancy our instruction queue is, no matter how many instructions we fetch per cycle, not going to solve that problem. All right, so I'm going to have my pipeline that fetches for all these adds at once, still have to do them one at a time because of these dependencies. So there's something we can do about this, though, as programmers. I'll give the example here. So here I have two ways of computing the same multiplication, and let's say we have a five-cycle multiplier. So how long does each of these take? And it's going to help to think about our pipeline, our data flow graph for each one. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with the one on the left. So who thinks that that's going to take, let's start with 8 cycles. 9 or 10 cycles. 11 or 12 cycles. 13 or 14 cycles. 15 or 16 cycles. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that this is 15. And that's what I get, because we have to do this, then this, and then this. And these each take 5 cycles to do. Even though we have a pipeline multiplier, we can't really take advantage of that. We have to do one after another. So how about the other case? So who thinks that this other case should take 8 or less cycles? 9 cycles? 10 cycles? 11 cycles, okay, 12 cycles, 13 or more cycles. Okay, so we have most people saying 10, otherwise people saying, and some people saying 11. So I think the way you get the answer for 10 is you say, oh, that first we do this and this, and then we do this. And this would work great except for one detail in the question, which is that we have a single multiplier. Even though it's pipeline, because we only have one of them, we have to give it only one thing every cycle. And this requires us to give it 2 things at a time. But the actual answer, taking that into account, is very close, because what we can do is we can do C times D, And in the next cycle, we can do A times B. So we end up taking 6 cycles to multiply A and B and C and D. Not 5, because we only have 1 multiplier. If we had 2, it would take 5. Yes, we'd save a cycle. And then we take an extra 5 cycles to do the rest. So it would be, it's 11 and 10 if we have 2 multipliers. It would be 10. Some questions? None. So finally, let's get to the thing, our big innovation that we're going to apply in the lab tomorrow, which is that this means we can reorganize the loop using this idea that we want to have sort of less dependencies. And there's a common pattern we'll see where rather than tracking kind of one index, we'll track multiple. And one sum will track multiple. So rather than accumulating one value, we'll accumulate 2. And then we'll add them together at the end. And by doing this, now I have more things that are independent of each other. So now I can do 6 things at a time. And my longest path is 4, even though I'm doing 7 adds overall. So this is going to allow me to finally take advantage of having the ability to start multiple adds per cycle by having multiple ALUs. And we can write the code like this. And if we apply that transformation, we'll see that, in fact, we get to go take advantage of our processors having multiple ALUs and actually get down to less than 1 cycle for adding 1 element. Because, well, we can do multiple adds in a cycle, so that makes sense. And next time, we'll look at some weirdness here, like why is this 0.57 instead of 0.5? Why does this get higher? We'll talk about what's happening there next time.